Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB 1310 on your AM dial. It's good to be with you today. How you doing there, Shani?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Never been happier. Do you know where I am today, since we record this intro early in the week, and today is Saturday, May 31st?
Where are you?
Beautiful Bangor, Maine.
Ooh, what are you doing up in Bangor?
I am up at the Democratic State Convention.
How exciting.
It is. I've been to a few of these conventions and caucuses, and always very interesting. Mike Mishu will be there and different folks from the party. So as this is airing, I will be up in Bangor.
Well, good luck.
Thanks.
Welcome.
We have a great show today. In a few minutes, we will have Bob Martin, interview recorded earlier this week. He's president of Maine Technology Institute, so we'll get to that. But let's look at what's on this day. 1990, sitcom Seinfeld premiered. Wow. TV Guide named it one of the greatest, or the greatest show of all time. Immediately when you hear that music, it takes you back. Were you a big Seinfeld fan?
Oh, yes. I loved Seinfeld. I still watch it.
Okay, Seinfeld question. You had to go to a deserted island, and you can only have one cast member be on the deserted island to hang with. Who do you think would be most interesting to hang with?
Kramer.
Kramer. On the deserted island, you go Kramer.
I would? What about you?
I don't know. George is a little nutty. Probably Jerry. I like Jerry's, it's kind of the easy guess, but yeah. Good question. What else do we have on this day? Wow. In 2005, on this day, the character who was part of the Watergate scandal, part of All the President's Men, who was referred to as Deep Throat, he was revealed. The gentleman's name was Mark Felt, and after 30 years of speculation, they let the world in on the secret that Mark was the person who was the inside guy that helped Woodward and Bernstein. And the interesting thing is, in just a few minutes when we have Bob Martin on the air, just in about 3 minutes, Bob actually worked at the Washington Post. And he talked a little bit about what that era was like back in the early 70s. So, interesting. Birthdays on this day. Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry. He turns 84. He is still going strong, I guess. Brooke Shields. Did I ever tell you my Brooke Shields story?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Brooke Shields, actress for Blue Lagoon, Calvin Klein. She turns 49. She was born on this day in 1965. In 92 or 93, I was tournament director of a big tennis event down in Atlanta called the AT&T Challenge. And it was the last event before the French Open. So it was a clay event, French Open, for any tennis fans out there, if this makes sense. And so all the American players, Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras, Jimmy Connors, Michael Chang, Malvia Washington, so all the top American tennis players, it was a men's event, would play at this event. And about 20 years ago, Andre Agassi showed up with Brooke Shields.
Oh.
I can't remember if they were married or dating, but spent some time with Brooke Shields. And when Andre Agassi went on to play on one of his first matches, he's like, "Hey, Steve, would you mind, sitting with Brooke during my match?" And I'm like, "Well, if you won't be jealous, then that's fine, Andre." And so Brooke Shields and I watched Andre Agassi play about 20 years ago.
Very cool.
Also on this day, Leah Thompson, also known as Lorraine McFly from Back to the Future. She turns 53. And Broadway Joe, Willie Joe Namath, quarterback from the New York Jets, he turns 71. Feels like he's always getting in trouble lately, but that's Willie Joe. But that's what we have for on this day. So why don't we get going with the show? We're going to transition right into an interview I did a couple of days ago with Bob Martin, and that will take us to the top of the hour. Bob is president of Maine Technology Institute, and then in the second hour, we have Michael Foley for the full hour. He is vice president of the Westbrook City Council, and he's had a fascinating career in government and government service. So without further ado, thank you for being with us today on Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM.
Stay tuned for more of Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB.
I'm voting because when I was growing up, my father told me that if you don't vote, then you have to shut up. Vote for the future of your children.
I'm voting because I want a voice.
I'm voting for a better planet.
I'm voting because it's my first time.
I'm voting because it makes a difference for the whole world.
I'm voting because I have the right to vote.
It's a beautiful thing to be able to vote.
And every vote counts.
This is way too important.
Let anyone get in your way.
Don't let anything stop you from voting.
Nothing.
No matter how bad the weather is.
Get psyched. Get out there. Come on.
Gather your friends.
Vote.
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 It's that simple. Vote.
We've all been there at the end of the line, frightened, confused, crying out for the smallest human kindness when finally there's a voice. Next. Most people would tell you that these visits to the Department of Motor Vehicles are the most hazardous times in a driver's life. But they're wrong. Dead wrong. Because the fact is, pollution caused by fuel exhaust is reaching dangerous levels. Right about now, you're probably wondering, what can I do? Plenty, my friend, plenty. Next time you're buying a car, choose one with the best gas mileage that meets your needs and fits your budget. Knowing that you're helping to keep our air cleaner and reducing our country's dependence on oil should slow your weeping the next time you're called in to renew your driver's license. For information on how to find a fuel-efficient car that's kinder to the planet and right for you, and for other easy tips on how to protect our world, log on to getgreen.com. It's easy to do, and you'll learn to save money on gas. Now, that's enough to make you smile. Next! If only for a moment. That's getgreen.com. A message from the Ad Council and Environmental Defense.
Welcome back to Tide Smart Talk with Steve. While you're listening to News Talk WLOB, it's in the way that you use it. I think that applies in a lot of categories, but we're here today talking about in the business context. I think Maine has some great opportunity for growth, but some great challenges. And today we have Bob Martin. He's president of Maine Technology Institute, and he's going to be here to talk a little bit about Maine technology and growth here in Maine. Thanks for being here, Bob.
No, you're quite welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. Before we get into the work that early in your career and most recently for the last couple of years as the leader of Maine Technology, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your background and what brought you here to Maine. To me, it's always interesting in how people found their way to what I think is the most beautiful state in the country. So if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your early years, and we'll talk about what you're doing now.
Sure. I started my career at the Washington Post newspaper. I actually started working there part-time when I was a student at George Washington University.
Is this the Katharine Graham era?
This is the Katharine Graham.
The Woodward and Bonstein, were they there then?
Or? They were indeed.
Wow.
Were indeed. Part one of the roles that I was in charge of customer relations, and I spent a fair amount of time during the Watergate era talking to advertisers who were displeased with the coverage the paper gave to the folks in the White House. And so on some occasions they threatened to pull their advertising because they thought the coverage was inaccurate and unfair. But I convinced them that that wasn't a good idea.
It's rare that media has comes under assault. To me, that's fascinating. I mean, that's a part of American history that goes beyond the political, and it really has it's impacted so much more than just what happened with Nixon. But what was the climate like during the All the President's Men era where it started out, and I'm sure many of our listeners remember it, but for those that don't, it started out as like a small story of a break-in. And then there were all these little threads connecting it back to the Republican Party. And then the threads grew, and then it became a conspiracy. And then famously, Richard Nixon's secretary, I think her name was Rosemary Woods, no relation to me, you know, she erased some tapes. But what was it like working at the Washington Post during what may have been the most turbulent time in journalism in the most turbulent town?
Well, on one level, it was just another day at the office, because at a newspaper, you're covering history on a daily basis. You're writing the first rough draft. So there were many things that were going on. But the Watergate story is, in my estimation, really a story of entrepreneur activity, because both Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein were fairly low-level reporters who had a story that nobody else wanted to deal with, and they were engaged enough in it to make sure that they uncovered everything that they could, despite the fact that the more traditional editors and reporters thought they were off on a wild goose chase. After a time, everybody sort of got the feeling that we've got something by the tail here. And so even on the business side of the paper, everyone was engaged with the activities that were going on in the newsroom. Now, remember, this was before Twitter, the Internet, the Facebook. And so, you know, people on their breaks would wander down to the newsroom to stand by the teletype machines to see the stories coming in. And that was always a fascinating place to go anyway, because the copy people would rip the stories off the teletype and hang them on a wall, and you could stand there and see what was going on in Afghanistan or some other part of the world. But the time lag was extraordinary by today's standards.
Yeah, I remember the era. I grew up outside of Boston, and I was actually a paper boy around that area, and we had morning delivery and then afternoon.
Right.
And there was no real, computer science was in its infancy and people didn't have connectivity. So for the most part, it really was about what came out in the newspaper, and people would open it up with but a whole different approach to news and what was happening in society in terms of the pace of it, in terms of how it was delivered. And, you know, working at the Washington Post in itself as an iconic paper had to be fascinating.
It was a great place to be.
Yeah, I want to, by the way, we have Bob Martin here in the studio. Before we talk about Maine Technology Institute, if you wouldn't mind sharing your thoughts from your experience early in your career in journalism and after the Post, I think you were with the Hartford Current. The difference between then and now, and there's many dimensions to that question, but relative to the public interest being served, do you think in the 70s, which I look at as, I mean, this may be naive on my part, as a purer time of journalism, where if you picked up the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, you were getting real journalism. Or if you turned on 60 Minutes and Mike Wallace told you something was happening in the Panama Canal, it felt like it was real. Now, in 2014, the commentary, blogs, opinion, soft news, it's all become so jumbled up. It feels as though the public isn't being fed a healthy diet of information or news, and instead we're getting the equivalent of junk food in terms of opinion and partisanship. But from your experience working at the Washington Post and your experience now as a business leader, do you have any thoughts about the state of journalism, or is it just a natural evolution?
Well, I think the state of journalism really hasn't changed from the very beginning of time. What we're interested in is information about our community. We're interested in stories about people in our community. So the ways in which that information has been shared with everyone has definitely changed. Now we're in an era where there is a lot of information. And so it's incumbent upon us to find ways to sort of categorize, organize, and deal with it. But that's not any different from the time when, in Washington, for example, there was a day when there were six newspapers. Each of them were different. And so while a particular event may have taken place, how each of those papers covered it was different. And so the perspective they provided was different. The opinions that they wrote were different. And so that's not really new today. What we have today is a lot of the same thing. And so for us to really be able to handle that information, we need to have some framework that helps us determine what's really important, what are facts, what conclusions are being drawn from those facts that I agree with. That's where we are. So I think the consumer today may become confused, and it's really not any different today than it was back in the day when Ben Franklin had an anonymous blog, for example, right, that he wrote. And people didn't like that then. And the way they expressed their opinion is not much different than now. So scale is different. But at the end of the day, I think newspapers, magazines, the broadcast media all serve the same purpose, sharing information to us so that we can draw opinions and actions from the information that we receive.
I think that the one counterpoint I have to that is, I think if somebody says, geez, I think President Obama must have been born in Kenya, and somebody says, what are you talking about? It was in the Honolulu paper, and the doctors had affidavits. He was born in Hawaii. It's just nonsensical to suggest that he was born in Kenya. Because there is such a mass of communication elements supporting that he could have been born in Kenya, it almost gives it a false credibility, whereas in an earlier time, there was only so many sources. And if you wanted to find the abstract, you looked at the National Enquirer, and then you went to Area 51, and you recognized, oh, that's where the four-headed,
right,
person landed. But now it's creeped into kind of mainstream information.
Right. So at the Washington Post, during the Pentagon Paper and Watergate era stories, which were the pivotal ones that the paper is known for, the story wouldn't be published with information unless there were corroborating sources.
Right. So that was the big theme of all the president's men, all the resistance that Woodward and Bernstein had getting it published, and Ben Bradley, the iconic editor. I mean, many of the scenes are all built around, did you get the second source? Did you get the third? Did you get it corroborated? Now it's, did you overhear something in an alley and let's get it on the internet, and then somebody reports that it was reported somewhere else?
Well, that discipline is absent at some levels in today's communication, because anyone with a smartphone and a website can become a journalist. And so that's where the reader or the listener has to do their due diligence to be able to understand whether or not this is a credible source, and whether or not there's a structured discipline at this organization to dispense news and stories that are grounded in fact.
You're listening to Todd Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB. You know, we have Bob Martin in the studio. We could talk about journalism for 3 hours, but you're here as president of the Maine Technology Institute, so I definitely want to get to that. But after being in the newspaper business, what was it that, how did your career evolve? Then ultimately, how did you come here to Maine?
Well, after the Post, and I was recruited to the Hartford Courant, and then recruited into the commercial printing and publishing business. And I've found my way to North Carolina, where I worked for a large global manufacturer of polymers and adhesives. And because of my background in the publishing business and understanding consumer marketing, I was hired by a chemical company to help with them with their marketing and their being able to respond to changes in the printing industry, where the digitization of printing was taking place and the properties of paper needed to change. So I got into that. I've been heavily involved in technology development throughout my career. When I was at the Post, I led the effort to take the paper from production from hot metal into computerized output, which at that time was an enormous task and a huge shift. And so, what I'm doing today with the Maine Technology Institute, being involved with a variety of different technologies, just feels like a continuation of the curiosity and appetite for change that I've always had.
So did you come to Maine specifically because of the MTI, Maine Technology Institute position, or were you familiar with Maine beforehand?
No, I came to Maine, one, to run a publishing company, and then got involved in creating a consulting practice that focused on mergers and acquisitions, turnarounds, and so I was heavily involved in that, was basically recruited from that role to help the Maine Technology Institute.
Well, why don't we start there, too? By the way, we have Bob Martin here. He's president of the Maine Technology Institute. For our listeners that may not be familiar, why don't we start with explaining what the Maine Technology Institute is, how it functions as an enterprise, or how it's funded and how it's reported, and then we'll talk about the work that you do in the future here in Maine.
The Maine Technology Institute is the state's venture fund for enterprises who are engaged in developing technology. We are an independent organization, a separate nonprofit 501c3. We have an independent board of directors. Each member represents a different sector or facet of the community, along with some statutorily required members, such as the presidents of the University of Maine system and the community colleges or their designees. And we invest public funds. We get an annual appropriation that we engage in our programs. And from time to time, there are bond referendums that are passed specifically for research and development assets. So MTI has been around since 1999, and it has evolved into a very strong and impactful part of Maine's economy.
Yeah, it shows here in my notes that you were appointed by Governor LePage and confirmed by the legislature in September in 2012. How does the Maine Technology Institute intersect or interact with the government, being the executive branch with the governor and the legislature, whether it has to do with funding approval or also, so you're a nonprofit, but because the funds come from the state, can you explain the linkage and kind of the scope of what the funding is every year that the public invest in the MTI?
Sure. The annual appropriation is in the neighborhood of $7 million, and this is for the Maine Technology Institute. And I am an employee of the state of Maine, but everyone else at MTI is not a state employee, but are employees of MTI. The intersection is because we are investing public funds. The legislature wanted a link between MTI and the rest of the government as part of an oversight. So I actually serve as an advisor to the administration and to the legislature in terms of technology-based economic development. So we craft strategies and plans and programs that we believe fit the needs of the state, and we have statutory requirements in terms of where we invest and the programs under which we accomplish that.
And before we get into the details of different programs and kind of different case studies, since it was founded in 1999, obviously it's operated under different administrations and under different control in the legislature from party oversight. How has in the history and in your tenure as president, how has the politics of government stayed separate and kind of segregated from this, which I think is a great opportunity for the state to really focus on business through technology? But are there any political elements, or is it more of an administrative link for funding and for oversight? And you're not a governmental or political organization anyway. I think your charter is pretty clear in that you're looking to advance technology and economic development here in Maine. But how do you avoid the political side? Because every day here in Maine, especially in recent history, everything becomes politicized, every expenditure and every effort. How does the Maine Technology Institute avoid kind of getting wrapped up into any of that?
Well, we are politically agnostic. We do not engage in programs to fulfill any particular administration strategy, and through the history of MTI, everyone has recognized that the decisions that MTI makes are based upon an analysis of science and business models, and we're not engaged in fulfilling any other objectives. We maintain a very strong, and because we are independent, we don't see ourselves as engaged in the political process at all, and I think folks on both sides or three sides of the aisle through the history of MTI have recognized and valued that. We're focused on science and technology. It's for others to engage in politics.
Fantastic. Talk a little bit about, since 1999 or 2000, MTI has invested over $150 million in Maine organizations. And from my notes, it says that you currently manage about a $102 million portfolio of companies representing industry sectors ranging from aquaculture, marine, to biotechnology, composites, and advanced materials, environmental technology, forest products, all of that. What is, you know, in a general sense, I think everyone has a general sense of what is technology, but what falls under the umbrella, because that's a pretty broad portfolio, and almost every industry utilizes technology in some way. So what is the charter or the focus for Maine Technology Institutes, and how do you decide what companies and what sectors represent the best opportunity to invest in?
Sure. So first, the amount of money that we've invested since the beginning of MTI has actually increased from the amount that you've got there. We're about at $168 million. Our portfolio is about $106 million right now. Last week was what we call Tech Board Week, where we went through a large number of applications and funded a number of them. And once our board of directors meets in June, we will approve them and probably add another $3.5 million to the amount that we have invested. So we are growing. The amount that we invested last quarter was record. We anticipate that this quarter will be a record in terms of the amount that's being invested. So what's technology and how do we make decisions? Well, we take a rather broad view of technology, and that is that if there is any discovery, any process that can amplify a business or create a business, we are interested in it. And so, as you pointed out, there are seven sectors that we focus upon, which capture pretty much all of the economic activity in this state, except for tourism or real estate development, which are outside of our purview. And when we talk to folks who are in some stage of development, whether early venture, pre-revenue, or even an established company later on, our focus is on what are you doing with science that will increase or your current business or create a new market for you. And so often we talk to people who do not think that they have a technology application. So, for example, we've recently provided seed grant funding to Bixby Bars. And this is a venture operated by Kate McClear up in Rockland, which is an organic candy bar. And so you think, gee, you know, candy, how's that technology? But you think about the process by which these items are made. And engaging science and technology into a business is enormously important. Almost 90% of the gross domestic product produced in the United States is driven by changes in technology. And so for a venture to understand that in their development is critical. But we also have a huge amount of engagement and development of products here in the state that are very pure technology. They may be in clean energy. They may be in bioscience, medical products, drug development. And so it's often not too much of a challenge to figure out whether or not a venture qualifies for investment. The decisions are made based upon, one, there is an independent, peer-reviewed assessment of the science and technology involved, and we begin with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And AAAS does a peer review with domain experts of the application to determine whether or not the technology is new, whether or not it does have some vibrancy and life. And then we have seven technology boards that are all volunteers. Each one represents one of those technology sectors. And those folks gather together on a regular basis to review the applications. That's what we did last week. So we've got 100 people involved in that. And all of them are deeply knowledgeable about the sector that they represent. So we look for technologies that, number one, are largely groundbreaking, and they may be very simple. And the ground they break may not be huge, but it's an advancement for a particular venture. Secondly, the impact has to be on Maine. We only invest in Maine companies, and we are keenly interested in what the side effects of our investment is in terms of job creation, business creation. We do not support hobbyists. We are supporting people who are actively engaged in building businesses. So the examples that we have in our portfolio are very broad and include a lot of different things.
By the way, we have Bob Martin. He is the president of Maine Technology Institute, a fascinating group that's been around for about 14 years. Their website is www.mainetechnology.org. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Bob, talk a little bit about when you talk about applications and you use Bixby Bars as a recent kind of case study. Does MTI invest in an equity position, or do you loan money? And is it about a funding source or seed capital? And if it is equity, what is the approach to managing the portfolio? And if you could talk about some historic successes or possibly failures where the enterprise hasn't succeeded and what we've learned from that.
Sure. So we have a suite of funding opportunities, starting with TechStart grants that are about $5,000, moving on to seed grants, which go up to $25,000.
So these are open to anyone. So if anyone goes to the website or connects with you and they have a technology-based or science-based idea or an operating company, there's different thresholds they can apply for support.
That's right. And then we move to development loans, which range from $35,000 to $750,000 or more. And then we also take equity positions. And so the key thing that you have to remember is that for every dollar we invest, you have to bring a dollar to the table. So we are co-investing with you. And in some cases, in some circumstances, we will recognize an in-kind contribution as part of that match. So when we make decisions, we are taking risks. We take a high level of risk like any venture fund would. So for our grant portion of our portfolio, Tech Starts and Seed Grants, these are funds that you can use to determine, one, whether or not your idea makes sense. So you can do some business modeling, you can do some market research, you can begin the discovery of whether or not you have a patentable technology. When you get to seed grants, you can start making and breaking things. When you get to the development loan stage, you should be in a position that you are approaching the engagement of the market. We call that commercialization. In other words, you're going to turn your widget into dollars. And so the development loan is designed to help you reach the market. If you're successful with that, and if you've begun to engage in raising money either from venture capitalists, angels, or private equity, we may take an equity position in your firm based upon our assessment of your business model and your plan of attack and what you're doing. And in some cases, we will help you raise capital by converting our development loan to an equity position, for example, to help you clean up your balance sheet. But we will actively work with you to help you approach those sources of additional capital that you're going to need. What we really fund is helping you cross over that valley of death that every entrepreneur engages in after they've used up all of grandma's money and their friends and family and tapped out their credit cards. They're still very passionate about their business. They know it's going to work, but they need additional funding, and that's where MTI comes in. And once we help you get your business to a state that's really able to be receptive to additional capital, we will help you raise that money.
Fascinating. We have Bob Martin here. Bob, talk a little bit about, you know, obviously it's a Maine-based enterprise, and it's focused on working with Maine-based companies in terms of either your investment or your equity position. Maine isn't known particularly either in Maine, in the country, around the world as being a technology center. You know, Maine's economy goes back hundreds of years and much more of a resource-based economy, timber, fishing, tourism, textile. What are the particular challenges and opportunity that you've seen as president of Maine Technology Institute to change both the thinking and the business climate and culture in Maine to be receptive, to start thinking about, because success builds upon success. And I think your group has had some success in this area, and there's other groups in Maine that are focusing on technology, and there's some companies that are doing great work. But we still, I think, have an image to most of the world is not being technology-based. Conversely, people think of Silicon Valley as a epicenter and outside of Boston. But where are we right now in the continuum, and where are we with future opportunity to really make technology more vibrant for the new economy?
Well, I think we are in an enormously strong position right now. So if you go to the website, there's a video on it. We call it our legacy video. And it makes the point that Maine is not just lobsters and lighthouses, but that innovation has been a part of Maine for many, many years. John Ruggles was a senator from Thomaston, a U.S. senator, and he is known as the father of the U.S. Patent Office. And he holds, or held, during his lifetime, U.S. patent number one, because he created a design for a locomotive wheel that had grooves on it so that the locomotive could go up an incline on snowy, icy rails. We have in this state a remarkable array of institutions who are engaged in world-class, cutting-edge technology. Jackson Labs, the Mount Desert Island Biological Laboratory, Bigelow Labs, the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and a number of labs at the University of Maine at Orono, the Maine Center for Cancer Research. All of these are engaged in remarkable pieces of technology, from working on regenerative tissue to finding cures for a wide variety of human ailments. And these institutions draw folks from all around the world. What we've been doing at MTI is helping to bring together not only the activities at those institutions, but also a hugely emerging class of entrepreneurs here in the state. And if you do any work looking at the web, you will find that Portland and Maine are beginning to be ranked in the top 10 cities, places in the country for entrepreneurial development. And that's largely because of people like institutions like the Maine Technology Institute, where we have funds, the Maine Venture Fund, the Maine Center for Entrepreneurial Development. And then MTI also manages the Blackstone Accelerates Growth Program, which is a $3 million contribution from the Blackstone Charitable Foundation that is has set aside $50 million to encourage the development of entrepreneurial activity across the country. And so we've used the Blackstone Accelerates Growth funds to catalyze the development of entrepreneurial activity in the state with a wide variety of activities. And I think more and more as I travel outside of the state representing MTI and our portfolio in front of investor groups and others, we're seeing a lot more traction of people recognizing that there's a lot more going on here than what we have traditionally perceived.
What can we do to even accelerate that growth? Is there something that you see that in Augusta from state policy standpoint, or something we can do with our education system or our approach to education or STEM or other parts of the mix that Maine needs to really focus on going forward, other than just having companies come and build upon what's already here? And do you have any particular ideas where in Augusta the state legislature should be a little more focused on creating either lower barriers coming into Maine or creating stronger magnets to attract business to Maine? Or is there something in our educational system that you're working with collaboratively to try to make graduates better prepared to find opportunity and create value after they graduate school here in Maine?
So a lot of issues in one question. So The first thing we have to recognize is that entrepreneurial growth and business venture growth is separate from a public policy type decision. It's organic. It arrives out of an entrepreneur's attack on a market or defining a market opportunity. To the extent that we provide the early stage funding that we have at MTI, I think that's extraordinarily critical to continue. I think we have to really celebrate in the state the whole idea of a culture of innovation. So we're a fairly risk-averse folk. We don't celebrate a lot about what we do. We don't talk a lot about what we do. We're shy and reticent. We need to amplify that. And so we're doing everything we can at MTI to celebrate and promote what's going on. And so I think for the legislative audience, the more deeply they are involved in seeing, understanding, and appreciating the entrepreneurial development, then that gives rise to a higher degree of confidence. When I appear before the Labor, Commerce, and Research and Economic Development Committee, I always talk about the companies in our portfolio because it's a boring conversation to talk about the different theories of technology-based economic development. But if you can talk about the excitement of a Kate McClear or a Kent Peterson or a Ben Polito in terms of what they're doing and the direct effect of what their business enterprises are doing in the state of Maine, that's an entirely different conversation. So we know, based on the latest biennial survey of the work that we do, we know that 42% of the companies in our portfolio have reached commercialization. They're beginning to create sustainable enterprises. That's a great number for a venture fund. Two, we know that the average salary of people who are employed by MTI portfolio companies is $68,500. That's well above the state median average. We know that 22% of all the patents issued to enterprises and individuals in the state, 22% of them went to MTI portfolio companies and in large part supported by the investment that we made. And we know that the internal rate of return on our investments for the state of Maine is about 12.5%. If I'm running a private venture fund and I'm looking at those numbers, I'm kind of excited about that because I think those are remarkably good numbers. We want to continue to expand that. We know that job growth among MTI portfolio companies, employees are being added at a rate of a 30% growth rate a year. So we know that what we're investing in makes sense. So how do we amplify that? Well, one, as I mentioned, we need to celebrate and expand this culture of innovation. We need to understand that we need to approach education from the standpoint of not only providing specific job skills, but a broad array of how to critically think. So one of my favorite business people in the state is Corky Ellis, who founded Kepware, which is a software company that creates the drivers that tell industrial equipment what to do. So when you buy a printer and you hook it up to your computer, sometimes you have to download the driver. That's the recipe to make that equipment work. Well, Corky's not a technological guru. He's an English major from Amherst College. My point is that we don't need to just focus on the engineering, the STEM skills. We need to focus on a broad approach to education. And finally, we need to understand that if we're going to be competitive in the U.S. or in the global marketplace, we need to approach our understanding of compensation in a different way. Maine companies pay lower wages than the rest of the country. And so if you're a company engaged in technology looking to hire an electrical engineer, you're in a competition. And so your wage rates need to be at a level that's competitive with not only the region, but the rest of the country. And until we really embrace that, we're always going to be not very successful in that competition. So all of these things are really outside of a public policy arena. These are things that arise organically as companies compete. And so you mentioned STEM education and our issues with getting people with STEM skills. You know, the state of Washington has a very active program to encourage programmers to come to Washington. Well, Washington's home to Microsoft. You'd think that there wouldn't be much of a competition, but they're in competition with California and other parts of the country. And so are we. And so we need to understand that.
By the way, we have Bob Martin here. He's president of the Maine Technology Institute. Bob, I'm sure you travel around the region and meet with investor groups and people that are affiliated with different types of programs. Every time I come back from Boston, I grew up in Boston, still a family down there, and I drive along 128. And in the 70s, that whole area inside 128 was a huge catalyst for computer development, both hardware and software and firmware. More recently, things have shifted quite a bit into biotech, medical tech. But you can't drive along 128 or go into Boston without seeing just tremendous growth, billions and billions of dollars of infrastructure and business growth. Do you have any thoughts on how we can benefit from some either halo effect or some annex effect? You know, we're only an hour and a half north of some of these sections outside of Boston. And what we have, I believe, is quality of life, and we have land, and we have open space, and we have room for growth. And what some of the restrictions on the economy down outside of Boston is the cost of living. And is there anything that you've seen at MTI where, we, you know, and I've often kind of, I was going to say joked with our governor, but I don't know if that's the right word. But I've been a little bit critical in terms of economic development, that instead of going to China to seek out economic development opportunities, he could jump on I-95, go down to Boston, and knock on some doors there and save himself some jet lag. Is there anything you see, since we're so close to a huge technology concentration outside of Boston, to specifically target either connectivity or growth from that pot of activity and bring that to Maine? Or are you in general looking more holistic and not specifically to one market or another?
Well, so why are places like Route 128 or Cambridge or the Research Triangle Park or Austin or Silicon Alley in New York, why are they vibrant and growing? What are the causes of that? And so if you look at all of those places, they have a couple of things that we don't have. One, they've got tier one universities that are large, that are deeply engaged in research and creating a whole cadre of graduate students who are doing that. And surrounding them are venture capitalists who can support the ventures coming out of that arena. So they have a resource that we think we don't have. But as I mentioned a moment ago, between Jackson Labs, MDIBL, the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, Bigelow Labs, and some of the labs at UMO, we actually have some resources that other places do not have. And so one of the things that we've been doing quite hard at MTI is engaging in creating regional opportunities to do that connection. There's no need for us to reinvent something here if we can take advantage of the resources in Boston. So we've got programs underway where we're reaching out and connecting not only with the venture capitalist groups in Boston, but we're also looking at ways that we can bring some of the programs at some of the universities there in that area to Maine. And that's particularly true in some of the entrepreneurial education that we're doing. But the second thing is, you talked about trade missions. Actually, to some extent, those are quite helpful. So a month or so ago, we brought over from Iceland an entrepreneur that has figured out and started a number of businesses that utilize the waste from fish processing and refines those wastes and creates a different set of products. So now in Iceland, the value that the fish processing plants receive from their waste is higher than what they receive from the sales of their fillets. And so what has he done with that? So, you know, we take fish waste and we turn it into compost. Well, he figured out ways with his team of folks to do other things. So at the top of the pyramid, they're able to extract collagen and other materials from the waste of the fish processing industry and turn it into pharmaceuticals and nutraceuticals. So at the base of his pyramid, he's getting about 50 cents a kilo for material going into compost. At the top of his pyramid, he's getting $2,000 a kilo for material that's refined it that way. So we've engaged with Thor Sigfusson and brought him over, and he met with a number of folks in our aquaculture industry, and we're looking for how we can find a way to create different types of processing in our seafood industry where we can capture some value from stuff that we normally think we either use as bait or just drop in the harbor. That's an example of what we can do. We also have quite a few companies, particularly in our portfolio, who are engaged in global sales. So Ocean Renewable Power Company has developed a turbine to capture the energy of the ocean's tides. They have a project in Eastport, but they're not going to grow based upon sales in Maine or even in the U.S., but they are growing because they're exporting that technology to other countries around the world who are on a much faster track in terms of utilizing renewable energy. So there are quite a few examples of that. So thinking globally, making those global connections is actually very important. I'm going on the next trade mission to Iceland and the UK for two specific reasons. One, to engage further in Iceland with the groups of folks that are doing different entrepreneurial things with fish processing waste. And I'm going with folks who have a very clear objective of trying to figure out how to bring that back. And then secondly, in London, going to be meeting with investors from the life sciences and the food production categories, because they're interested in investment opportunities in this country. So it's a way to evangelize our portfolio and, again, attack that perception that there ain't much going on here.
Well, I agree, but I still think 128 is fertile, but I agree with your point. I think it's interesting what you mentioned about the seafood industry, which, you know, just from the sounds of it, sounds very innovative and could be certainly applicable here in Maine, where we have such a an important industry there.
Well, in terms of Route 128, MTI is a part of the New England Council of Clean Energy Council. And this is a regional effort to tie together all of the resources in New England and New York that are focused on clean tech, clean manufacturing, renewable energy, so that we can connect and share the resources that are here. So with the E2 Tech organization here in the state and quite a few of the companies in our portfolio and outside of the portfolio, we're actually making those connections and sharing those resources.
Well, fascinating. We're running out of time here. I want to really thank you for being here. It was fascinating, and I know that the bulk of our conversation was on Maine Technology Institute, but loved hearing about the Washington Post and the history of all the president's men. So thank you for being here today, Bob.
Delighted. Thanks for having me.
We've just had Bob Martin. He's president of Maine Technology Institute. You can find out more information at www.mainetechnology.org. And if you or a family member or a friend has a business or some sort of commercial enterprise where it involves any kind of technology here in Maine, and you're looking for possible funding sources or sources for insight or best practices, I encourage you to go to Maine Technology Institute for information and possibly apply for some funding. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Thank you.